I think one thing that I really learned from it is there are different ways in order for you to recruit. You have different ways. You can be creative in how you can recruit volunteers.
Yeah.
And
gunpoint works good.
again?
Gunpoint.
Yeah, the gun. But there are so many creative ways that Pastor Mark shared a while ago. Like they go to Enchanted Kingdom, they go to
Star City.
Not Star City, but they have a hangout sometimes just for them to invite some more volunteers to be a part of the ministry. So in my context, I think I'm still thinking honestly if that would be possible in our context.
Yeah, okay. Edrie, are you cold? Are you cold? I just wondered. Wow. Well, we're going to start church history this afternoon. And we'll be doing that as we continue systematic theology and New Testament. So, let's give you the whole batch. You got notes, I think? New notes? Yeah? Everybody have notes?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Lessons from Church History, Session 1. Our outcome-based objective, the goal of this course, is to provide an introduction and foundation for systematic theology so that we're more grounded in the truth and able to lead God's people through the many challenges facing us. Church history gives you a context and a foundation, a basis for systematic theology. It's difficult to understand the fine points of systematic theology without a historical context. Usually when we have that sound, it means that somebody actually has an electronic that's on and it's near a microphone. So make sure everything's off. So we look at church history because it gives us the overall perspective, and the stuff that we learn in systematic theology begins to fit because it didn't just come in a vacuum. It arose because real issues took place in the history of the church, and God's people had to go to His Word and discover, well, what does the Bible say about this particular thing? So, we have to look at a proper view of history, first of all. How do we have what's the right way to look at history? There's a lot of different ways to approach the whole idea of history. A proper view of history is essential to interpret the facts of history accurately. Every worldview approaches history differently, but they all must answer three basic questions. Is history cyclical or linear? You understand what I mean by that? Cyclical versus linear. In other words, linear is there was a beginning and then dates took place after. Cyclical means it's a constant going back and forth in a big circle. So Eastern views of history are cyclical. Western are linear. Another question they have to answer is history random or purposeful? In other words, is there some overarching goal to history, or is it just random facts? My friend Stephen Mansfield wrote a book called More Than Dates and Dead People, which is a good understanding of providential history. It's more than just dates and dead people, which to a lot of people thinking about history in school comes down to just dates and dead people. Memorize all these dates, know these dead people, pass it on the test, and then never think about it again. But providential history is more than that. It's purposeful. There's someone directing the events of history. And then finally, is history optimistic or pessimistic? So you see a little chart there. We got a view of history, the Eastern worldviews that come out of the Eastern world that are informed by Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. Their view of history, it's always cyclical. We're just going around in endless cycles of reincarnation, right? And every once in a while, the lucky one hits nirvana, which means you escape the cycle of continual birth and rebirth, and you merge into cosmic, universal nothingness. What a glorious future we have. Eastern worldview towards history is also, it's somewhat random and it's somewhat purposeful. In other words, there is a world spirit, a Brahman, this cosmic essence of the universe that's sort of directing it. Although in the end, because we just merge into cosmic oneness, nothingness, in that sense, it's random also. And it's pessimistic, not too exciting to get up in the morning thinking, this might be the day I merge into cosmic, universal, undifferentiated nothingness. What a glorious day. It's pessimistic. Darwinian, or the Western worldview, is linear. There was a beginning, the Big Bang, and we're moving along. We're heading somewhere. It's the ultimate heat death of the universe, when there's no more usable energy left, and everything just comes to a dead standstill. But it is linear. It's random. There is no being, there is no force that is informing the facts of history. Why did that happen? It just happened. Stephen Jay Gould, a noted evolutionist, said, if you wind life's clock back to the beginning and start again, you'd never get man a second time. It was just a random accident that could never happen again. And it's pessimistic. The ultimate heat death of the universe. Again, hard to get really excited about that. There's no real future in it, either for myself, because when I die, I just merge into the materialistic stuff of the universe. And if I happen to be alive at the end, we just go into cosmic heat death and it's still dead, yeah. Now, the biblical view is called providential. In other words, there is a being behind it. And biblical providential history is linear. There was a beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and we're marching along a line. We're heading towards some point. It is purposeful in that God is directing the events of history, which makes history exciting because it's not just dead dates and dead people. It's God, why did that happen? What are you up to? We're watching events unfold in history, and we, with a providential view, we ask ourselves, God, why? What are you doing? What's happening behind it? We know the cause and effect, or at least what we're being told. This thing led to that. This person said this. All these various nations did this and that. But what are you doing behind it? Because He is directing all of history. It really is His story. Joseph?
You tell me if you think this will be helpful, but I was just thinking how, apart from a view of God, ultimately there is no purpose in anything we're doing.
Right.
And if you could just give a comment about that, about how to explain people who don't believe in God and yet still live every single day as if they have purpose, you know, like...
Yeah. Where well, are now, they getting we're in apologetics, and it would take a lot to say that, but... Okay. People cheat. That's the basic answer. Because here's the problem. You can't live in God's world and be inconsistent with the way God made things. God made the world to work a certain way. If you live in God's world but you reject Him, you have a different view of how things work, but that doesn't accurately describe how the universe works. It works the way God says it works, you see. So you can have views about there is no God, there is no being, there is no ultimate end of life. And as a human being, you can't face the reality of that conclusion. If you were just be totally honest with yourself, if that's the case, then eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And I might as well take as many people with me as I go. That's the logical conclusion. But because we're created in the image of God, something inside screams, that's not how it is. And so you have to cheat. You have to pretend. You have to make up meaning. But that would take a whole different course. The history of philosophical thought from the pre-Socratics to the present time. One of my favorite courses, but we don't have time for that now.
That was Ryan's favorite course also in the States.
Ryan did not like that. Ryan did not like that course. Joseph loved that course. Ryan still is mad at me. Providential history. Are we making some points here? Providential, yeah. Purposeful, optimistic. The end will be glorious. So history provides, there is hope for man. We're heading somewhere. And each generation, we just get one step closer to the ultimate goal of God's victory, His final victory in history. Why is it important to study church history? And I got to convince people, because most of the people in class, usually in a class this size, you'll have 50 to 60% hated history in school. And then you get a few that were just kind of neutral, whatever. And then you've got a few crazy people that really loved history. Okay, those are people who are easy to sell about church history. But the majority of you got to convince, why are we learning about history? Why is it important to study church history? I'm so glad you asked me that question. Church history shows the gradual execution of the divine plan of redemption. When we look at church history, we see God at work causing His purposes to come to pass from generation after generation. As one group gets a word and a mandate from God, they fulfill their purpose, pass on that baton to the next group and the next generation and the next generation. And we see God's ultimate purposes step by step being fulfilled in history. We become a part of that. And Christianity, unique from all the other religions in that it is a historical religion. It's based, it's rooted in history. If you're a Buddhist and you read the writings of the Buddha or the story of the Buddha, whether the Buddha actually lived as a historical being or not is really immaterial to your faith in as a Buddhist. It's not based on historical facts, one way or the other. They could be myths, they could be true. It really doesn't matter. Christianity is entirely different than that, in that if the facts of Christianity are not true, then there is no Christianity. You see, we can't on Easter just celebrate the birth of the Christ Spirit within all of our hearts. No, it'd be much better to go out and get drunk than to do that. If Christ has not actually been raised from the dead, if there's not historical facts behind what we believe, then we believed a lie. And of all people, we're the most to be despised. We're the stupidest and the most foolish to give our life just for some kind of immaterial, sort of ethereal kind of feeling about the brotherhood of man. Christianity is a historical religion rooted in history. And so as we study history, we see God, the outworking of His purpose and plan. Yes, Joseph, you're not going to let me get too far today, are you?
No, I'm just curious. Before, would it be okay if we asked a survey, like among all of us here, which ones are excited for church history, which ones are the not
so? Will they tell me the truth? Because then they'll think, if they don't raise their hand, I'll get mad at them, call on them.
No, I think they'll tell the truth about this.
Well, Christian, let's ask it this way. Prior to this course, okay. Prior to knowing that I was going to teach it, how many of you would have gotten pumped knowing church history? Yeah. Let me see. Okay, there's a few freaks here. How many would have gone, I just hope I'm sick that day? Or got a better excuse? Yeah, okay. All right, everybody raise your hand. I'm going to pick on you. Number two, church history is the key to understanding the present condition of the church and the guide to our future. How the heck do we have any idea of what to do next if we don't know what came before us? It's no idea whatsoever. Could you imagine you got to go take over a campus ministry? And they throw you in charge, first meeting, but you know nothing whatsoever about the beginning of the ministry, when it started, what the history of it, who's been the leaders, what's happened the last year, the last month. You're just thrust in. You're not going to make very many good decisions. The first thing you're going to do as a leader is you're going to get the information. Tell me about what's been going on. What are we doing? Why are we doing that? Well, 5 years ago we started this, and then this led to that, and that led. Okay, that makes sense, you see. Now I've got a context to make accurate, wise decisions. How can we have any idea what God's up to and what we're supposed to do if we haven't seen what's gone on before? Deuteronomy chapter 32, Moses says, "Remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father. He'll inform you. Your elders, they'll tell you." Winston Churchill said, "The greatest advances in human civilization have come when we recovered what we lost. When we learned the lessons of history. We cannot say the past is past without surrendering the future. The farther back you can look, the farther forward you can see." Fascinating. Many people consider Winston Churchill the greatest statesman of the 20th century. And yet at 65, he was washed up. His political career was over and he had been marginalized, because in the early 30s, 1930s, he began to warn the nations about this rising threat in Germany, this man named Adolf Hitler. You see, because Churchill was a devout student of history, and he began to try to ring the alarm to the Western world, because he said, "We've seen this before. I can tell you where this is heading, because this pattern has been repeated throughout history." But nobody wanted to listen to him. Nobody would hear. And yet everything that he predicted would happen came to pass. But finally, it came to the point when the Western world was on the brink of being taken over, that they called him at 65 years old, May 10th, 1940. They asked him to come and assume the government of the United Kingdom. And he said, "I was born for this day. My whole life has been a preparation for this moment." See, because he understood history and he knew what to expect, you see, he could prepare for what's coming because he could see these patterns happening all through history. And as we study church history, we don't get fooled. We don't get surprised and shocked, because we've seen it so many times before. The names have been changed, different labels attached, but the same old story over and over. Number three, our final reason: church history is a treasury of warning, encouragement, and counsel. Every age has a message from God that man must understand. You see, one of the influences of the evolutionary worldview, which has affected us here in the Philippines because of Western influence, one of the effects of the evolutionary worldview is it undermines the value of the past. Because in the evolutionary concept, you see, we are progressing, right? We're always going to higher forms. So why study something that was inferior? And so in the West, of the influence of Darwinism, that worldview, we don't look to the past. We almost disdain the past. Like, we're cool. We're upbeat. That is so 1990s. We're in the new world now. Why would we look back? But there is so much wisdom and insight for us. Job said, "Ask the former generations. Find out what their fathers learned. For we were born only yesterday and know nothing. And our days on earth are but a shadow. Will they not instruct you and tell you? Will they not bring forth words from their understanding?" Let's look about preparation for the church age. Paul, writing to the Galatians, said, "When the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth His Son." That's a crucial phrase. The fullness of the time. Have you ever wondered, why 4 BC. Why? Out of all the possible times Christ could have come, why then? Because it was the fullness of time. God had prepared the world for the advent of Christ. Briefly, we'll look at a few ways that He prepared the world for Christ. God, number one, prepared the world politically for the advent of His Son. More than three centuries before the birth of Christ, Alexander the Great created a vast empire stretching from Greece to the Indian border. His entire empire fragmented after his death, but the Greek language and culture he instituted remained. Eventually, Rome would incorporate Alexander's conquest into its own empire. By the birth of Christ, there was a vast geographical region that shared a common culture and a common language. Alexander is a fascinating individual. His father is Philip of Macedon, who was a great conqueror, military leader. And Alexander was trained by Aristotle. He was his tutor. And so he instilled in him a love of the Greek language and Greek philosophy and Greek learning. But Alexander was highly ambitious. There's a story told he was 17 years old and his father was returning from a major military battle. He conquered this particular nation. And as he approached, Alexander was seen weeping. And they asked him, "Why are you weeping?" He said, "Because I'm afraid that when it's my turn to rule, all the worlds will have been conquered. There will be no more nations for me to conquer. It's like, Dad, save some for me." Well, he came to power at 21, and he began to take over the known world. He really only reigned for about 13 years, but during that time had conquered the entire known world. And everywhere he went, he established the Greek language and Greek culture. And so what happened, even though at the end of his life, his empire fragmented into four general sections, he had so deeply inculcated Greek thought and philosophy and language and schooling and education that this Greek language and culture carried on. And when the Romans come in later and essentially conquer all of Alexander's area, they maintain it politically, but culturally it's still Greek. So what we have is this monolithic culture and a monolithic language. Everywhere you go, everybody speaks Greek, and everyone thinks with a certain mindset and a common culture. And if you know anything about cross-cultural missions, real cross-cultural missions, this is huge. You see, all those barriers that people have to cross when they go to a new culture, they don't have to cross now. There's this massive network of all these nations that have a common language, so you can go. You don't have to learn new languages. They have a common culture, so you don't have to learn how they think and work through all those various things that happen when you do cross-cultural missions. And all this was the providential hand of God using this wicked and evil man to accomplish His purpose, which is one of the great lessons of history. We see that God raises up terrible men and women, but He uses them for His purpose to accomplish His plan. And that's what He did for Alexander. The empire of the Romans extended from Britain in the west to present-day Iraq in the east, north from the German border to Egypt, and the whole of North Africa in the south. Now, this is a massive geographical region that is being controlled by the Romans. Never since have Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East been united in a single political unit. Think about this. All the Middle East, all of Europe, North Africa, under one political unit. The Romans. I mean, this is an amazing thing. The Romans created this united empire and a rule of law. See, everywhere you went, the Romans established judicial system and court systems and provided peace and order, where prior to that, there'd been chaos and disorder, and it's very difficult to preach the gospel in a situation like that. Not only that, they created the greatest roads that people have ever seen. Most all of the major motorways in the United Kingdom follow the paths of the original Roman roads. And often underneath the tarmac is the remnant of the Roman roads. There are bridges still in England. When the Romans got there, Romans founded Londinium around 32 AD. And they started building these bridges, and they still exist. There's they built a massive wall because they could conquer England, but they couldn't conquer the Scots. You know, I mean, William Wallace and all those fellows were his ancestors were there. And so what they did is they created this massive wall, 79 miles wide. They just put a whole wall to stop them from one ocean to the other. And there were four at every mile. You can go and you can still see that wall built by Hadrian and his army in 116 AD. They're incredible builders. And they build these massive roads. And not only build the roads, but they patrol them. See, because prior to that, maybe there was roads, but you couldn't get very far without bandits and pirates. And they also cleared all the pirates out of the sea. So the Mediterranean was free for travel. Prior to that, you couldn't expect to go on missionary journeys. What we see Paul doing would have been impossible apart from the Romans. The Romans cleared it out. God's preparing the world for the quick spread of the gospel. Fascinating, isn't it? You stop and ask yourself, when you look at things that are happening in your nation, Lord, others just see cause and effect, and they see political issues and economic forces and factors. But what are you doing? What's happening in our nation politically? What's the Holy Spirit doing behind that to prepare for revival and the outpouring of God's Spirit here in our nation? Because he's always at work in the events of history. Second thing, God prepared the world spiritually for the advent of his Son. Spiritually. There was a great moral and spiritual vacuum waiting to be filled in the first century. The spread of Greek philosophy with its inherent skepticism had challenged paganism, but left the populace with little confidence in the old gods. Paul Johnson, one of my favorite authors, said the world was intellectually ready for Christianity. It was waiting for God. See, here's one of the amazing things that takes place is the Jews have been spread all throughout the Roman Empire. And there are these colonies of Jews and synagogues all throughout. And because of all of the movement in the Roman Empire, a lot of people have been removed from their ancestral home, and they're settled in these big cities now. They've been moved there by Roman troops, and they're looking for connection. And there's such loose morality, they begin to be attracted to the Jewish synagogues. Because in the Jewish synagogues, first of all, they've got this concept of monotheism, which begins to look very attractive to the pagans. The idea that there is not this plethora of gods that are constantly battling one another, but there's actually one divine being who created all things. It looks very appealing and intriguing. And the other thing they like about the Jews is the way they live. Their moral uprightness and ethical probity. And the way when they shake their hand in the deal, you know it's a done deal. They're men and women of their word, and there's a great appeal to that. And the main thing that's drawing and attracting them is there's a sense of community. You see, we're living in a world here, first century, there are no social services whatsoever. You've been displaced from your family. You have needs that arise. There's no government agencies. There's no way to get. There's no charities. There's no organizations. You're just going to die. But in the Jewish synagogues, you see, they have this whole system, relational system of caring for one another. and this looks really appealing. And so there's these massive quantity of the way we call them God-fearers. They're pagan Gentiles who are attracted to the synagogue, but there's two big issues. You know what they are? All the men know what one of the issues is. It's circumcision. That's a deal breaker. Okay, we want to hang around the synagogue, but we can't go all the way. And then the other one that's just almost as important is the dietary laws. I'm not giving up my pork sausage. And so here God has prepared these massive groups. So Paul and the apostles, they go to these Gentile nations and cities, and they speak in the synagogues, and here's all these Gentiles, and they hear this gospel preached. They get monotheism, one God. They get ethics, and not only ethics, but the ethic giver will come and live inside of you. We get real community. We don't have to get circumcised. We can eat anything we want, and we get a living personal relationship with God Himself. Man, I am in. And massive quantities of Gentiles start to flock into the church. See, God's preparing the world for the advent of His Son. How are we doing? The lesson we learn is that God sovereignly prepares people and nations for the advance of His kingdom. Let's run through the apostolic age really quickly. The apostolic age extends from Pentecost to the death of John, from about 30 to 100 A.D. John probably didn't make it to the end of the century, but pretty close. The field of action was Palestine, Asia Minor, Greece, and Italy, and the most prominent centers were Jerusalem, Antioch, and Rome. Now, there's three stages of this early part of church history. Stage one, Pentecost, the Jerusalem Conference. Peter is the chief apostle. That's why the first 12 chapters of Acts are about Peter, for the most part. He laid the foundation of the church among the Jews and the Gentiles. Stage two, then, from the Jerusalem Conference to the persecution of Nero, 64, 65 AD. Paul was the chief apostle in the second stage. He established theology of justification by faith throughout the Gentile world. Stage three, from the persecution of Nero to the death of John. John revealed new dimensions of Christ in his insightful writings that concluded the New Testament. Now, the Jerusalem Conference is one of the most significant events in all of church history. It's right in the middle of the book of Acts, and it is the linchpin of the entire book. And the context here in chapter 15, verse 1 and 2, says that some men came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the brothers, unless you're circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved. Well, this brought Paul and Barnabas into sharp dispute and debate with them. So Saul and Barnabas were appointed, along with some other believers, to go to Jerusalem to see the apostles and elders about this question. Now, the primary issue of the Jerusalem Conference was circumcision. Circumcision, a vital question in the apostolic age, because it involved the larger question of the role of the law and the relation of Christianity to Jerusalem, to Judaism. You see, we get a little hung up on circumcision because it's not a burning issue in the church in the 21st century, but the real issue here is, what is the gospel? Is the gospel a past event and a current status, something that Jesus Christ has done for us and that we live in the current reality? Or is it something that we have to do? The keeping of the law. Circumcision is about the keeping of the law. Now, the Jews were concerned because the Gentiles were nasty. Okay, when we talk about sin, the Gentiles of the first century, they knew how to sin. They had master's degrees, doctorate degrees in sin, and all sorts of perversions. And the Jews, the believing Jews, now the ones who become converted, they're thinking, if we let those suckers in without some kind of regulation, who knows what the church is going to look like? If it's all justification by faith through Christ alone, you got to be kidding. This place is going to be Sin City. We need to put some restrictions on them. So it's not really about circumcision. It's about what is the gospel? Is the gospel Christ plus something? Or just Christ alone? The crucial issue. And, of course, if circumcision becomes a prerequisite to Christianity, you're essentially going to stop the advance of the gospel. Paul's mission to the Gentiles forced the issue of circumcision because the Jewish believers considered Judaism the necessary introduction to Christianity. A zealous minority was alarmed at the progress of the gospel among the Gentiles and saw it as a threat to the purity of the church. There's quite a bit of jealousy involved. Number three, the establishment of faith as the only requirement for salvation ensured the universality of Christianity. Now, the reality is we're still fighting the same fight. It's not about circumcision now, but it's always Christ plus something. Wherever the gospel goes, wherever it advances, the idea that you're justified by faith, not by something you do, is always going to have a vocal majority challenging it. We've been studying the book of Romans in our Sunday services. When we get to, Paul has laid out the essence of the gospel through chapter 5. And so the logical question, the beginning of chapter 6, shall we continue in sin that grace might increase? If you don't ask that question, and the question in a sense is, if we're justified by what Christ did, it doesn't have anything to do with what we do, why should I change anything about my behavior? Yeah. If you don't ask that question, you don't understand the gospel. But as soon as you ask that question, you show that you don't understand anything about the gospel. But when you hear the gospel first, your thought is, you mean we could just, it doesn't matter, it's not about a series of rules and laws? No, it's not. Then what's going to keep me? See, the fact that you asked that question shows that you have not experienced the grace of the gospel. Because when you actually do, you don't really ask that question. Because you don't even want to think like that. But it was the battle in the first century. And we'll watch this as we progress through 2,000 years of church history. The names will change. The ideas will change. But it always comes down to it's a fight over what is the gospel. And we have to be clear in our own mind. That's why we preach the gospel to ourselves every day, don't we? We remind ourselves of the gospel every day. Because the battle in our own souls is the battle. Will we believe the gospel today? And will we defend the gospel in our preaching? Persecution in the first century. Things heat up pretty quick. July 19, 64 AD, the most destructive fire in Rome's history began. It engulfed 10 of Rome's 14 regions, left thousands dead and homeless. The fire destroyed most of the city, its temples, monuments, buildings, art collection. Public rumor traced to Nero, who wanted to rebuild Rome and call it Neropolis. Nero had a little ego issue. He started off as a pretty good ruler, but at some point, maybe after Paul preached the gospel to him in 62 AD and he rejected it, at some point he went insane. He had his mother clubbed to death. She was interfering in his life. Had his brother and wife and family members killed. He forced his tutor, the Roman writer Seneca, to commit suicide. He was a dark individual. And when the fire burned through the city and destroyed so much of the city, and the loss was just terrible. And there's no insurance, there's no social services. People have lost everything. And then, of course, food begins to be short and people start getting hungry. And when people experience things like that, they always look for a scapegoat, someone to blame. Who's making my life so miserable? Someone that I can lash out against and attack. And so they began to suggest that it was Nero. And so there's a groundswell beginning to rise up. Nero did this to us. And so Nero's a good politician. So to divert suspicion, Nero cast the blame upon the hated Christians. You see, that's what good politicians do. They find someone else from the other party to blame. He's the real reason for all of the problems. So he crucified and killed many in violent and gruesome ways. Some were sewn in the skins of wild dogs, a wild beast, and exposed to mad dogs in the arena. He covered men and women with pitch, nailed them to posts of pine, and burned them as torches for the amusement of the mob. You know, there are two different ways to die when you get burned at the stake. We'll see a lot of burning at the stake throughout the history of the church. We've been pretty famous for burning people at the stake. There's two different ways you can burn someone at the stake. There's the merciful way, and that is you put wood that is damp. And so what happens is it produces smoke. And so the person dies of asphyxiation long before his body melts. Now that's the gracious way. The other way, what Nero did, he covered them with pitch, like tar. Now, the human body, it takes a long time to burn the human body. If you're going to cremate a body to completely destroy it, it takes, at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, a fire 8 hours. So the body, the human body, you live a long time as you're burning to death. And here are these believers. They're jammed on these poles because he's having these games in the amphitheater where they're giving the Christians to the lions and various things like that. But it's dark. So enable the people to get there, he's got to create street lamps. And his street lamps are Christians on poles burning. And so you're finding your way to the amphitheater because you can hear the screams of people caught on fire as you're walking by. And the people are loving it because somebody else is experiencing a worse pain than they have. According to the overwhelming testimony of the church fathers, how y'all doing? We'll have our stack in a moment. You can think about burning torches. We're both martyred during this persecution, Peter and Paul. Peter, because he wasn't a Roman citizen, he was crucified. And he wanted to be crucified upside down because he didn't think he was worthy to be crucified like his Lord. And so he crucified upside down, most likely on the very spot where the Vatican and Rome is to this day. Most likely. Paul, because he was a Roman citizen, you couldn't crucify a Roman citizen. A Roman citizen was, the capital punishment was beheading, which is a lot easier. You want to be beheaded if you got a choice between crucifixion or beheading. Crucifixion, now Christ died, they were shocked that it only took him 3 hours to die. Oftentimes they would linger for 24 hours or even more. But beheading, it's quick. Although the key is, and this will surface all throughout church history, you've got to tip the executioner well. If you don't, he's gonna hack at you a while. If you give him a good tip, he'll make sure one clean, so death is instantaneous. If he doesn't like the tip, he's just going to torment you for a while. So you give him a good tip. Bam! It's over. You're in glory. Hallelujah. Oh, my, my. We're almost time to... Let's take a break here, and we'll come back. That's a good time to break. 3:35. 3:35.